This is Jason Horsley and The Liminalist, the podcast between. What follows is the second part of my conversation with the author Temple Grandin. The first part can be found at horticulture.com/liminalist. One of the kind of ideas behind my website Horticulture is that there's this overlap between what we call artists and what we call autists. And
there's a lot of overlap. There's lots of overlap. I mean, there's a lot of artists that are on the spectrum. I worked with a lot of skilled trades people, welders and other trades. There's a big meatpacking plant where the whole maintenance shop's full of old hippies that I know are on the spectrum, and they've been there for years. They're getting up to retirement age now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, even in the origin of the word autistic from autos, it relates to the self and immersion in one's interior world, and that, of course, is what artists do, is they, you know, they bring stuff out from their interior space and then communicate it. So one of the premises that I've explored with horticulture is that, you know, how much is the difference between an autist, somebody who's diagnosed as having a problem, and an artist, somebody who's celebrated as being this great, you know, public communicator? How much is the difference between to do with
people? Yeah.
Well, so, but what makes the difference? I mean, how much does it have to do with simply an ability to communicate what we're experiencing internally, and how much of that rests on the audience to be able to receive it? So, I mean, how many autists, if there was more of a space in which they would be received and would be heard, would be able to communicate? Do you see what I mean?
Well, I think there's a lot of people, you know, famous scientists and musicians. There's been a number of books written about them. One of them is Asperger's and Self-Esteem, about famous scientists and musicians that probably were on the autism spectrum. You know, I think we live in a culture today that puts more value just purely on social. And because I can think of all the kind of kids that were kind of different that I grew up with that would definitely be labeled autistic today, that were just sort of labeled different when I was a kid.
Right.
See, I had severe speech delay. I was not fully verbal until 4 years old. I had very severe speech delay. When I was 3 years old, I looked really, really severe. I was not one of the more Asperger types where there's no obvious speech delay.
Well, I mean, in retrospect, my own childhood behavior might have been diagnosed today. Like, I didn't smile. I was sort of preternaturally or prematurely intelligent and eloquent, so Aspergerian. I didn't like physical contact, I didn't like being kissed. There are a number of what would be considered tells now, but it wasn't so prevalent, the diagnosis. But also, I grew up, although it was very far from an ideal background, it was quite a bohemian background, and both my parents were and their parents were very, thought very highly of artists and eccentrics and individuals. So add that to the fact that I was coming into money when I grew up, I never really felt any pressure to conform or to create a social persona that would be, you know, acceptable. I was actually willing to be a freak and to be a misfit and to stand out, because I considered that part of being an artist, and I wanted to be an artist. So in that sense, I was quite lucky, because actually my
And when I was a young child, my ability in art was always encouraged.
Yeah.
I was given books on perspective. I was encouraged to do lots of different kinds of art, and then in my, you know, job on designing things, I used my ability in art. You know, one thing I get very concerned about is schools taking out things like art and music. I think that's just horrible.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that that's happening? Do you have any guesses about that?
Well, I think they're just worrying about scores and reading and scores and, you know, that everybody should be going to college.
And
there's a lot of kids getting shunted aside because they can't do algebra. I'm one of those. So how did I manage to get through college? Because thank goodness in 67, algebra was not the required class nationally. Nationally, the required class of 67 was finite math, which is probability, matrices, and statistics. And that saved me. But there's a lot of kids today that are just, you know, getting stuck on algebra. They won't let them go to geometry and trig. And the schools are getting are too rigid into, you know, what's done one size fits all.
Sure.
And it doesn't. And you know, how can you learn, you're going to like a musical instrument, you never get a chance to try one. You know, and nobody's worked on, you know, developing it, you know, getting you to develop your art ability.
So which would you consider more important then, for a person on the spectrum to be socialized enough to get a job, or for them to have enough room and encouragement to develop their interior aesthetic sense and to be creative?
Well, one of the problems you're getting now is video game addictions. And boy, I can tell you, I would have been one of those addicts if that had been around, and they're not doing, some of these kids, they're not doing art or music. Now, maybe some of them could make some money video game tournaments, but what's happening on most of them is becoming just a recluse in the basement. I don't think they're happy. And I just was talking to one parent the other day where their child was in a program where they were working in a greenhouse, and he was also building a greenhouse, and he loved it. He just loved it, and that got him away from the video game. You know, I think it just gets back to, you know, too much in our society today is taking out the hands-on things.
Right.
And you know, a lot of these kids are not expressing, if they're just sort of getting into a video game addiction, and they're not having good outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them ending up on Social Security disability. I mean, the kids I've seen that have been, you know, more successful are, you know, they had paper routes when they were kids, and I mean, I learned work skills when I was 15. I was cleaning 8 horse stalls every single day, and I was very proud of the fact that I ran the horse barn. I got recognition for being, I put the horses in and out. I was responsible for feeding them the right amount of feed, and I was proud of the fact that at 15, 16 years old, I basically ran a horse barn. Now, I did not do the financials, but I did just about everything else.
Have you thought about, or talked about, or written about at all the possible relation between autism and the growing degree of neurodiversity in the species and the technology?
Well, I think that a lot of the kind of eccentric people have always been around. I think it's happening now. I'm seeing a lot of kids way, way milder than me. You know, I see a lot of kids where they're just, you know, the artist kind of kids, the music kind of kids. Now they're getting a label, and I'm seeing too many of them where they get overprotected by the parents. I ran into one kid. He's a very good video animator, and he's just 15 years old, sitting in his room all day doing that, and the opportunity came up to do some animation for somebody just, you know, in an office just a mile down the road, and I said, well, this guy'd be good at doing that, And the mom got really upset and says, I just can't let go. And I said, I'm talking about having just worked in an office of somebody you know very well, editing some video, and he's going to get self-esteem from editing the video well. But he was just being overprotected when he should have been getting out. Because when I was his age, I went to my aunt's ranch, and mother gave me a choice. She said, well, if you hate it, you can come back in a week, and if you love it, you can stay all summer. I got out there, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. But I was scared to go. You know, and this kid, it would be a great opportunity for him to get out and edit some video for somebody else. But you see, this is where they're kind of just getting smothered, and all it was an office just a mile down the road with people they knew. When I was a child, TV was limited to 1 hour a day. And I recommend with a lot of these young autistic kids, we limit the video games and the YouTube videos and just, you know, mindless web surfing to 1 hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
And get them out doing other things, like music or art.
But do you think there's actually a biological change that's occurring in these children or the species due to technological factors or environmental factors?
Well, I think that they're going to be way too much screen time, and the American Council of Pediatrics recommends, especially with children under 3, maybe no screens at all.
Because it changes the brain.
It does change the brain.
Right.
And I think screen time needs to be limited. I'm not suggesting banning it. You know, I was allowed to do my 1 hour on a weekday, and I had 2 hours of TV I could watch on Saturday and Sunday. 2 hours on Saturday, 2 hours on Sunday, and the shows had to be approved by mother.
So it seems this is a very big part of your message, or what you want to communicate, is to be more engaged with the environment, to be more physically active, to be using one's body more. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that's one of the things. But, I mean, we talk about, when I look at some of the people that are, you know, in the past that were really great people that were probably on the spectrum, people like Mozart.
Yeah.
I mean, he was into music. You're playing video games all day, you don't, then you're not doing the music or the art or learning computer programming. I've introduced a lot of parents that said, hey, here's Khan Academy website. And you can learn computer programming. You want to know what the hot languages are? JavaScript, C++, Python, and Ruby.
Hmm.
You learn that, Silicon Valley is hiring. A lot of those lessons are free. You know, so if a kid is addicted to Minecraft, let's introduce him to JavaScript. And they're going to find out what makes Minecraft work.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody has to introduce it. What I'm finding is they don't learn the computer programming by osmosis. Somebody has to say, hey, you want to find out how video games work? Let's learn some programming. Somebody's got to, in most cases, introduce the programming lessons. They're not learning. Now, old-fashioned DOS days, kids would learn it on their own. But today, the computer guts are hidden, and somebody's got to formally introduce the programming lessons.
Thank you.
think you mentioned changing the subject, that you don't really engage in emotional relationships. Is that right?
No, that's pretty much right. I've created intellectual complexity. I like intellectual complexity.
Mm-hmm. In others, you mean?
Yeah, I really like it. I get a lot of satisfaction when I can solve a problem.
Mm-hmm. So you mean that the relationships that you find most satisfying are when you can work together intellectually to solve problems?
Well, that's right. And one of my students go out and they're successful. That makes me really happy. When I work with, all the building projects I worked on and get a project done and it's working, and I had to learn how to work with the other team, with everybody to make it work. I used to say engineering is easy. It's the people problems that are hard.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think most people have people problems.
Well, so many people just have, there's so much psychodrama over the dumbest things.
Yeah.
I just found out today, we have two professional associations, the American Society for Animal Science and the American Society for Dairy Science. And we've been having a joint meeting, which I really like, because you get a lot more posters and a lot more papers. Well, 2 years from now, they're going to stop doing that because they were squabbling over whether or not they should have free coffee and food. That's a really dumb reason to squabble over and end up not having our joint meeting, which I love because I like getting all the extra papers all in one meeting. And they squabbled over food, whether they should pay for food or not pay for food at the reception and for a certain amount of coffee stands.
Hmm.
And I'm going, that's just stupid. And unfortunately, it was people of my generation that were responsible for this stupid squabble.
Right.
It wasn't me, because I'd say, one group wants to have a lot of free coffee and free food, and the other group says, let's save money and not do this. I would tend to say, all right, let's have half as much food. Compromise. That would have been my solution to the problem. But to me, that's such a silly thing to squabble over and end up having those as separate meetings.
So then this is, I guess, part of your experience as what Oliver Sacks called an anthropologist on Mars, is observing most humans kind of being swept.
Well, politics in this country's gone absolutely crazy. I go to other countries, they laugh at our politics.
Yeah. For example?
Well, I won't go into any examples. That gets too sensitive.
Oh.
But all they do is fight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my generation, I'm in my 60s now, in the 50s. Boy, we got stuff done. The Democrats want the moon, and the Republicans built the interstate highway system. We did stuff,
mm-hmm.
my generation. The government actually worked.
Right. So,
and that's about all I'll say.
Well, I brought it up in relation to what I was imagining your experience with most humans being carried away by emotions and being triggered all the time and acting and reacting emotionally and therefore not getting things done.
Well, it's gotten worse with social media. People just, boom, make a reaction, and they don't make an emotional reaction. They don't get time to get their brain engaged.
Yeah.
It's made a lot of this stuff worse. And also, my generation, everybody read the same news, got the same news. Now everybody's sort of more getting just into their niche of people that they're communicating with. And I think we need to get out of the silos.
Yeah, well, I just had this experience actually at my website. Somebody's just announced that they wouldn't be reading my work anymore because they got so upset about an argument I made. And it was an entirely theoretical argument. I was merely trying to illustrate a point about ideology, but they took it emotionally, and so it became something else in their mind. And so I would say that, this is being an Aspergerian, I suppose, a part of that is that I'm also can seem to be very unemotional, to be emotionally insensitive, and even be that, because I think that emotions need to be used intelligently. And
well, and people get way too high. See, one of the problems you've got on the online stuff is people see stuff and they just get hot-headed and write stuff on, you know, they would never say to anybody, you know, to their face.
Right.
You know, and you just get a great big reaction. And I've had some message boards, and people can have dissent. I mean, okay, I'm in the meat industry, so some people don't like the idea of eating meat. So if somebody writes on a message board, you know, I think meat eating is wrong, I don't take that down. On dissent's fine. But if they start just using a bunch of F words and just things that are way too vulgar for me to say now, that comes down.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in any dissent's fine. We don't take dissent down, but because I've got some, you know, industry videos, but when it comes to, I'm not going to repeat the vulgarities, just absolute vulgarities. I take that down, because otherwise the message board turns into a cesspool, and just a few potty mouths yell back and forth on it, and not everybody else leaves because too much potty mouth.
Well, sure, and I mean the discussion gets derailed so quickly.
Well, it totally gets derailed. I mean, there are some people where they're so nasty that if you're running a message board, you're just going to have to. It's fine to disagree. That's fine. Okay, if somebody puts on a message board, okay, I think eating meat's wrong, we don't take that down. But if they get put down stuff where it's not, stuff I just can't repeat that's so vulgar, so nasty that.
Yeah, well, it does seem to be getting worse, as you say. I mean, it seems that the art of debate, which was once so valued, is almost totally lost now. And people even.
Well, I think it's. I think this is bad, and because there's a lot of problems that have to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that are more logical are the people that, when things really get messed up, are going to have to, you know, fix serious problems. We have serious water problems in this country. I'm in agriculture, and I've looked at maps. Where the satellite can detect how much water's been depleted in the aquifers by looking at minute gravitational changes. And that map of the world of where the aquifers are depleted, that's scary. I mean, we've got serious problems we've got to fix. And they're the kinds of things that need to be fixed in a logical manner.
Yeah. Are you familiar with something Einstein said, which was that problems can never be solved by using the same thinking that created the problems?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that quote, but I've got other Einstein, you know, I've wrote about Einstein a lot, Thinking in Pictures, in my book, Thinking in Pictures.
Yeah. Well, I like that one. I don't know much about Einstein, but
I like that too.
Yeah.
But I think there's a need to have civil discourse where people can agree to disagree on certain issues, and then maybe be able to talk about other issues where they have areas of agreement.
Yeah.
But there's some people where, people just get in like flame wars, and it's not constructive.
Yeah, well, I'm prepared to address this if I get this community radio going, because it's a small community and they tend to just interact on Facebook, and there's a lot of, apparently I don't do Facebook really, but there's a lot of this, what we're describing, the fighting and the bickering and all the rest of it.
Well, then the thing I've found a lot of these things is that there's relatively few people that are, you know, might say spewing the worst venom.
Mm-hmm. But it only takes a couple to sort of reduce the whole thing to that level, I think.
Well, that's why you have to moderate the message board, and some people have to be kicked off. Now, if they can talk in a civil manner, they can disagree all they want, but just do it in a civil manner.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my experience is the problem seems to go deeper, and that this is more a symptom of an underlying thing, and it has to do with how more and more, again, there's emotions, how people mistake their emotions or their feelings for opinions, and then they mistake their opinions for facts, and then so they come around, they just are throwing feelings around as if they're actually making arguments, and they're not. There's no discussion or debate going on, there's just emoting, and I feel it acutely as being...
Well, one thing I am very concerned about today is I don't think a lot of the younger generation are reading enough stuff, you know, to get a deep understanding of a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I'm a big reader. Like, I get on a plane, I'll read the New York Times, I read the Wall Street Journal, I read all the business magazines. I love the business magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Because I get to read all the business gossip. I'm not interested in movie star gossip, but business, all the business stuff, all the characters that are in the business world, I like to read about them. And I'll read science magazines. I've subscribed to like 5 science magazines. I just love them.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really disturbs me when I look at my science magazines is they're all full of ads for hearing aids. And I'm going, well, aren't young people reading Science News or Discover magazines?
Mm-hmm.
But all these advertisements and the walking bathtubs and hearing aids. You know, that's all advertising, you know, to older people. Well, Science News is something great, you know, little magazine to keep up on the science stuff, and I hope younger people are reading it. I was happy to read some survey data that showed that about a third of young people are reading in national papers, such as New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but that's only a third of them. But I think it's sad that a wonderful science magazine is now, all the ads are just going for all us older generation people. Younger generation people ought to be reading a science magazine, because we do have a lot of important issues, like water issues, because I'm in agriculture, so look at stuff about water issues, and we need to think about these things intelligently, and you need to know some science in order to do that.
You probably noticed in relation to this, though, that there's a growing mistrust in the younger generations for science and for institutions in general, and turning away from any kind of official sources of information. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, but you see, well, the other thing is you have to learn how to read science, because there's garbage in science, too. And you have to learn how to, you know, how is a study done? You know, was the study confounded?
Yeah.
You know, just something very, very simple. Let's say I'm looking at some cattle behavior stuff. Well, cattle breed affects behavior. And so if you're doing your study properly, you do statistics where you use a thing called the covariate that mathematically can remove the effect that maybe Angus cattle behave differently than Hereford cattle, just to tell something very simple. You know, and you have to make sure studies aren't confounded. And scientific method needs to be taught in the schools. You know, they're teaching kids how to read and do math, but they aren't teaching kids how to do scientific experiments.
Right.
You have a hypothesis, and then you test your hypothesis.
Well, I hated science at school. I actually ended up quitting it. I was so bad at it that they let me stop taking it, and that was because of the way it was taught. They weren't really teaching the scientific method. They were simply teaching the facts, the supposed facts, that the scientific method supposedly has discovered, and they're very different things. Like, the science is an institution now, and I don't think you can separate science as an institution from ideology any more than you can separate religion.
Well, that's different. You know, obviously scientists are human beings, but
yeah.
I've spent a lot of time on Google Scholar looking up a lot of science, you know, and I might download, you know, 10 journal articles on one subject, and they have opposite results, and then I very carefully go through the methods and figure out, well, maybe the difference in the results is they had Brahma cattle instead of Hereford cattle, you know, or the cattle were calves rather than bulls, you know, things like that. You look at differences in the methods, and there's scientific studies where they're biased in a bad way. You see, I don't look at it in the abstract and go, now, is this a good study? You know, one study on pig handling, for example, they were looking at the effect of a drug on pig handling, and they had a confound by how the amount of distance they had moved the pigs. The controls in the experimental group had a different amount of distance the pigs had to walk. That confounds your experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I picked that up in the methods. Mm-hmm. When I review scientific papers, and I go over the methods. I'm the methods police.
Right.
Because you've got to get your methods right to make sure you're not confounded.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going with that. And I think the scientific method, like the art of debate, is being lost in the shuffle largely. And I think that there's something inevitable and maybe even healthy about the distrust of younger generations for the official version of things? I mean, we know that the media...
Well, I don't just take the official version of things. I read a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have my students do in my class, in my cattle handling class, and is and this isn't really cattle handling, but I felt this was something that they needed to learn, is to learn how to dig into the scientific literature. So I say you could pick out anything you want in animal behavior, but it has to be narrow. Like maybe is there different is there differences in cat breed, for example, in behavior, or grazing patterns on, you know, does a type of pasture cattle on affect their grazing behavior, something like that. And then I want two journal articles off of each database, Web of Science, PubMed, Science Direct, and Google Scholar, because I want to learn how to use these databases, because most students don't even know these databases exist.
Right.
Google Scholar and PubMed and Science Direct, free. You can get free summaries of journal articles off these databases. I think it's important that students learn how to use these databases. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I have that assignment. And I'm finding that about two-thirds of my students really need to have that assignment. And I've had students come to me and say, I solved a family health problem with what I learned on how to use databases. I didn't even know these databases existed.
Mm-hmm.
I want to teach them how to look into things deeply so they don't have to just say what, you know, some official thing is. They can get in that, and they've got to get deep into the scientific databases. And you can find stuff that doesn't come up readily on just regular Google. Google Scholar is wonderful.
So do you think that this is, it seems that to teach somebody that, to look deeply and to really explore and test and question, they also need to be, or maybe primarily need to be, have their curiosity awakened, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's right. You know, and what I tell the students, I said, you can pick out anything you want animal behavior. So I know a lot of you are pre-vet. So if you want to do dogs and cats, that's fine. But you can't just do dog behavior. That's too broad. I want to make something narrow because I'm going to force you to dig in those databases and really learn how to use them. I said, get a number on your keywords. You've got a lot of different keywords for cattle. Calves, bulls, heifers, cows, steers. You've got to use all the different keywords in different combinations.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any interest in psychology?
Yes, I was a psych major, in fact.
Oh.
One of the reasons I was a psych major is I wanted to figure out what made me tick.
Mm-hmm.
I was a psych major as an undergraduate.
And what branches of psychology did you study, or did you go back to Freud and work your way from there?
Well, I was very interested in experimental psychology, optical illusions and things like that, and when I went to school, everything was behaviorism.
Yeah.
Now, Freud got brought up, but we didn't study him very much in the late 60s when I went to college.
Yeah. So, because your view is, as you've said, is generally biological, so how do you factor in the psyche, the idea of the psyche, as a separate field or a separate phenomenon from the body, or is it a different way of looking at the same thing?
Well, I think it's a different way of looking at the same thing.
Hmm. Do you feel that there's because the psyche means the soul, no? And so psychology really in its strictest sense is the study of the soul, which of course is a religious concept, and yet the psyche, yeah, if we just think of it as the unconscious, is an indisputable fact.
I mean, well, one thing I'm learning is that I don't really have an unconscious because I can see all the graphics files. And it was a shocker to me to learn that most people don't see the specific visual images. Like if I say to you, think about a church steeple, how does it come to your mind?
Yeah.
I was shocked to find out that some people get a vague pointy thing. I just see specific ones. And I can name off where they're at.
Oh, it's ones in your past, ones that you've seen, photos.
Ones that I've seen, that's right.
Right.
And especially the ones that I go by all the time.
So when you say that you don't have an unconscious, you mean that you have access to what's in your unconscious?
Well, what I'm finding out is that things that are unconscious in most people, I can see consciously.
You can bring them up consciously.
Yes, I can.
Yeah, but they would still be in your unconscious until you actually bring them up, if you see what I mean.
Well, but you see, most people have a layer of word thinking that covers it up more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, for most, I don't remember my first 7 years, for example. So there's no doubt that I did live those 7 years. Therefore, the body has memory of them somewhere. But that proves that I have an unconscious, because I don't have memory of 7 years of my life, you know? and I don't have access to it, unfortunately. But that's a separate thing, I think, than the unconscious, because, as you pointed out, we need an unconscious because we can't be conscious.
The way my mind works, if you can show me things that act like key words, that brings up all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the mind works like Google for images. Now, the difference is that Google for images lays the pictures out like an old-fashioned light table.
Yeah.
I see them come up sequentially. Put a keyword, and they come up sequentially, and they're associative.
So it's like a comic strip or a movie.
Well, you know, it's one at a time they come up. And then if I hold the picture in my mind, I can turn it into a movie.
Okay. So can you rewind and play back images? Do you have some measure of control over that?
Yes, yes. In fact, when I was doing equipment designing before, you know, three-dimensional, you know, CAD modeling was invented, I could actually test run plant equipment in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go, that's not going to work. You're going to pull the rail out of the ceiling.
Wow. That's remarkable.
I thought everybody could do it. And I got in a lot of fights, calling a lot of people stupid. Now I've learned that the engineering mind, the mathematical mind, doesn't see it. But the engineers need us visual thinkers to prevent accidents like Fukushima.
Uh-huh.
Because what I learned is that the mathematical mind didn't see all the water pouring into the non-waterproof basement all over the emergency cooling pump. I'd see the water coming in there. Simple watertight doors would have prevented that accident.
Right. So does this method work for personal problems as well? Say if you've got some disagreement with somebody or something that's not working out, relationship, can you run it through this image system?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've helped people with their relationships.
That's interesting. So you must have an empathic understanding for how emotional relationships...
Well, yeah, and I find out exactly what the, you know, I find on troubleshooting, most people don't ask enough questions. I find the same thing on dog behavior problems. Someone will say to me, my dog's crazy. Well, what's a crazy dog? Is it biting somebody? Now, my Cheryl Miller, my assistant, she's got this cute little corgi, fluffy corgi, and I call him Mr. Wiggles. And he just had to jump all over me yesterday. Now, is he a crazy dog?
Uh-huh.
You know, now I see a picture of Mr. Wiggles, or I can see something very scary growling at me. And those both could be a crazy dog. I have to ask a lot more questions before I know what they mean by crazy dog. Because is it crazy happy or is it crazy depressive?
Right.
You know, I can't even answer if somebody says to me, what do I do about crazy dogs? I can't even answer that.
Right.
I have to have a lot more information.
It's too vague, yeah. And can you do this internally? Like, can you ask yourself internal questions and then consult with this?
No, I just ask the client questions. I go, okay, your dog's crazy. What did he do?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what he did.
Now, I understand the example, but I'm wondering if it works also if you're alone, if you have this kind of interior oracle that you can consult.
Well, yes, and I kind of rehearse different ways that I could do something, yes.
Yeah.
I could do this, I could do that, yes, and I like to see an image of doing it.
So, and essentially, you're seeking what is the right way forward, what will bring about
the desired outcome. Well, I found out that calling people stupid is a really bad thing to do, but on the other hand, I found out that some of the people that I used to call stupid were a mathematical mind, and they couldn't see the things I see. I can't do the mathematics. We have to work together.
Yeah.
Our skills complement each other.
Sure. Well, you know, earlier I was trying to get at something that you found a bit abstract, and I was saying it was like instinct, but it was also intuition. It was some internal guidance system that I think the body is built into the body, or maybe the body even is that internal guidance system. And so it sounds like that's what you're describing, that you have this...
Well, I basically, you know, say, okay, if I did this, what might happen? You know, and it kind of plays out like a movie. If I did this, I went off and I just told this person off.
Yeah.
It might be a really bad thing to do.
And is it purely logical, or is there an intuitive thing where you can actually somehow foresee an outcome through means other than pure logic, would you say? You can kind of see the way things
are going. Well, no, I kind of weigh the scales of justice. I really like the visual analogy of the scales of justice, you know, risks versus benefits, pros versus cons, and, you know, look at different things. Okay, which way does the scales of justice go?
Hmm. So this justice is presumably not a social justice, though. This is some...
I'm just using it sort of like, okay, I'm trying to figure out my probability of success.
Yeah. Right.
But I rehearse everything in my mind. I'm going, well, it's going to be a lot of traffic in Boston, so I've got to allow extra time to get to the airport. Because right now I'm actually seeing... The flight I almost missed in Boston because of traffic.
Mm.
I'm seeing the road that I was on trying to get into the tunnel to get to the airport in Boston.
And does it extend also to kind of ethical questions where you're just not really sure what the right thing is to do?
Yes, it does. And now I see things as pictures.
Yeah.
You know, the different things you could do.
So in all of your studies of animals, I imagine you've come across this phenomenon that domesticated animals, cats and I think particularly dogs, have an ability to know when their owner's going to come home. Like they can anticipate it somehow. Have you come across that?
Come across what? When the owner's going to do what?
Well, before the owner returns home.
A lot of dogs are there waiting at the door.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They know when it's time for the owner to come home.
Yeah. So, but is that... I mean, it seems as though one of the reasons this has been written about is that it doesn't seem to be sensory. They're not hearing or smelling.
They just have a good time sense. Animals have got a time sense.
Yeah.
It's just like the dairy cows will come in to be milked.
Oh, you mean if the owner comes home at the same time every day?
Oh, yeah, because usually the owner comes home at the same time every day. They're very, very sensitive to details that people tend to not notice. One of the things I teach my students, I want you to look at what the cow's doing with their ears, because they listen to things with their ears, and they can move their ears independently. You know, and I have to teach, you know, it's important to teach the students to, you know, be more observant.
Have you read up much on parapsychology and ESP and all of the research that's been done into that?
Well, lots of times you can, you know, I find a lot of people out there that are really good animal behaviorists, and they're very, very, very sensitive at picking up, you know, differences in the animal's posture.
You mean that accounts for, I don't quite follow.
Well, I can't really say that. I mean, in a lot of cases it does. I mean, I've had parents say to me, oh, my nonverbal son knows, you know, when I'm getting ready to leave. Yeah, but he sees you, you know, quickly tidying up the dishes, you know, getting the dishes finished and, you know, bustling around. You know, the cats know, our cat always knew when we were going to go on vacation, when we were going to travel and run off. Yeah, they see the suitcases come out and and you're kind of like moving around differently.
Mm-hmm.
Animals are sensitive to when there's a change in routine.
So you don't think there's the cases where there's no clues that there's something subtler going on?
Well, I think animals are they pick up a lot of little clues that, you know, when you think in language, you tend to not notice.
Yeah. I'm sort of on the fence. I mean, I've had too many experiences that I couldn't explain through the, you know, sensory means or through purely physical. But on the other hand, I think what we're capable of physically and what our senses are capable of is little understood anyway. So who knows what we're picking up. But I've certainly had precognitive experiences where I've dreamed about something that then happened, for example. That seems...
Well, there's sometimes things you can't explain, but...
Yeah.
I think a lot of times with animals, they're very sensitive on picking up things. Cats always tend to jump on the people that hate them. I've seen that happen over and over again.
Well, the autism field is so wide. I mean, I'm sure you couldn't not be aware of how many different points of view there are.
Well, there's a lot of points of views in a lot of different things. And one thing I always push is we've got, you know, little kids that are not talking. You know, this is a place where I've promoted ABA. I don't promote ABA on older, fully verbal kids. They've outgrown ABA. In fact, the good ABA people will say that. You know, but get little kids talking. I mean, if somebody hadn't worked with me when I was young, I don't know what would have happened to me.
I was just reading today about Donna Williams and how you kind of had a disagreement about facilitated communication. Do you remember that? Do you want to comment?
Well, there's three books I always recommend. Tito's, How Can I Talk? My Lips Don't Move, Carly's Voice, and The Reason I Jump. Because those three people communicate completely independently. And I recommend those books to teachers, especially if they're working with older children and adults that are nonverbal, so they can understand the those sensory difficulties.
So when you say they communicate independently, what do you mean?
Well, okay, Tito, for example, I met him. We met in a quiet medical library. And he came in, was flapping, looked very, very, very severe autism. And his mom said to him, well, Tito wants to tell you about autism. And I go, no, I want to talk about something else because I wanted to make sure there was no rehearsal. So on the bottom of a pile of old Scientific Americans that was in this library, I dug to the bottom of the pile and I paged through it and I found a picture of an astronaut riding a horse in the desert. It was for an ad for a technology company. And I showed that picture to Tito, and he types very fast, Apollo 11 on a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And he typed super fast, and then he got up and flapped. And it was clear that there was no way he could have been cued. No way. And
right.
He typed super, super fast. You know, there was no question that he was typing independently.
Okay. So, but you're juxtaposing this with facilitated communication because there's sometimes.
Well, it's okay to use risk. I will support using risk support to get things started, but eventually you've got to get your hands off them, especially if they type slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem you've got if they type slowly, you know that old IBM computer. It was called the ThinkPad, and it had that little red button in the middle of the keyboard to move the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I take and I put my finger on somebody's shoulder, I can move, I could cue them the same way the IBM ThinkPad moves the cursor around. And now, if they type really fast, you wouldn't be able to do that, but if they type slowly, you've got to get your hands off them eventually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now if they want to use facilitated communication to get started, yes, that's fine.
Are you familiar with Michelle Dawson's work?
Some of her work. Which work?
I was just reading today about how she's looking into the ways in which autists are being portrayed in the media and by certain researchers and certain supposed scientific studies as being more tending more towards criminal behavior, to becoming criminals. And she's looking at this whole kind of framing of autists as potential criminals.
I'm gonna have to read some of that. One of the things I do feel very strongly about, especially for verbal people, they've got to learn some words. They've got to, I'm seeing too many kids aren't learning basic things, like how to go in a store and buy something and talk to the clerk, just, you know, how to buy something in a store.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the first time I had to buy gas for a car myself, and back in the days when they had attendants, and I was scared to death, but I did it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's always a danger of being scapegoated, as if you stand out in the community or in a social group, then that makes you a threat, simply because there's that tendency to fear and distrust outsiders. The group projects onto the misfit all of their own fears and then scapegoat them, and of course that can...
Well, I mean, when I was a child, rules were, you know, pounded into me about really bad things. You just don't do them.
Right. Well, but you don't have to do bad things, is my point, is if you're just socially awkward and you're not giving out the cues that put people at ease, they will start to imagine that you will do terrible things. I mean, I had that experience as a kid. And
one of the things that I found that, you know, this is, when I was in my 20s, I had a very strong urge. I wanted to prove the world was not stupid.
Mm.
And that motivated me to do my projects. And I found that when I take out my drawings and show them to somebody, they go, "Oh, wow, you were weird, but you did that." And that motivated me to, you know, design more stuff and get it built.
Sure.
No, I was motivated to prove to people I was not stupid. That was a very, very big motivation I had when I was in my 20s.
I'm guessing you're not motivated by that anymore.
No, I don't think I'm motivated by that now, but I was sure motivated by that in my 20s.
Yeah. So what's on the horizon for Temple Grandin then? What are you working on now and what's to come?
Well, I've been doing a lot of speaking engagements, or working on some research projects. So I had a student finish up some work on Angus cow mothering behavior. I had another student just did a great project on cattle handling out in the feed yards, and that's something that's greatly improved. So that's something good.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you were never a vegetarian, is that right?
I couldn't be a vegetarian if I wanted to. If I don't have meat, I just feel faint and weak, headaches. I got to have some animal protein.
Right.
My mother's the same way. She's got to have a sausage in the morning, or she just doesn't feel right.
Well, my family background is my family business, my father's business. It was a dairy that he then turned into a food corporation, and they included slaughterhouses and meat products, pork and beef. And when I was about 16, I saw a film, I think it was called The Animals Film. It was a documentary that was quite famous in the 80s, and it showed the conditions in slaughterhouses, and it was so horrific that I became a vegetarian.
Slaughterhouse is a whole lot better, and you might want to look at Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin, and also there's Pork Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin.
Yeah.
You might want to take a look at it. Just type in Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. It comes right up on Google.
So I can feel better about eating meat.
You can Google that, and you can look at it in Pork Plant Video Tour, too.
Mm-hmm.
Things have improved a whole lot.
Do you think?
And some of that's a result of my work. I worked very, very hard on improving the slaughter plants. They're not perfect, but they're way better than they were in the 80s. In the 80s, they were horrible.
Mm. So have slaughterhouses taken up the policies and the methods that you've introduced to the ones you've worked on everywhere, or is it just in the ones that have the grip?
The most important thing is the management.
Mm-hmm.
And what really made the change was when large corporations like McDonald's insisted on standards. I developed the standards, a very, very simple scoring system, and I taught the McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King food safety auditors how to do the scoring, and it resulted in big changes. And even some of the older plants with older equipment were able to do a good job when they made simple changes, like maintenance of equipment. That was big, 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 big.
Mm-hmm.
Training employees, changing lighting. Cattle are scared of the dark. They light up the chute right, make sure it has no reflections, they'll walk right in.
Would you eat at McDonald's?
I eat at McDonald's. I really like their sausage biscuits.
So, and when you do talk about the cattle have decent, comfortable lives in the slaughterhouses, I mean, I'm really surprised. I find it very hard to believe. Aren't they all packed together in very small spaces?
Well, yeah, I'm put on a truck. Most of the problems I'm seeing now in animal welfare are things that are happening outside the slaughterhouse. Slaughterhouse was easy to fix. One of the biggest things we had to do to it was repair it. And things, simple things, non-slip flooring, training, management's got to care. USDA's gotten a whole lot more strict now, too.
So, but the conditions of the cows, I mean, while they're being raised, before they get
there's some real problems with dairies. There are certain dairies that let dairy cows get in a very bad condition before they are sent to slaughter.
Yeah. And chickens also. I mean, do you eat battery eggs, for example?
I have to eat what I can get out on the road.
Right. So you can't really afford to have principles about
that. I have to eat what's available on the road.
Mm. Do you think...
You know, in a hotel, I have to eat what they have.
But if you have a choice, is it something that you consider?
If I bought eggs, I'd probably buy, some of the eggs raised a little bit better, but I have to admit I don't really buy many eggs because I'm traveling so much that a dozen eggs is going to go bad before I can eat them.
Yeah. So you're on the road a lot for your...
I'm on the road a lot, that's right.
Being a spokesman. Have you ever heard the word liminal or liminality before you did this podcast?
I don't know what that means.
It comes from the word for threshold, and so a liminal state is a state between one state and another state. So, for example, being a teenager is being liminal. But there's also ways of living. So, I mean, gypsies are liminal people because they are always on the move. What you're describing, that you're always traveling, that makes you kind of liminal. And autism is a kind of liminal thing because autists are not really part of society. They're kind of in this margin where, but they're not completely ostracized.
Well, a lot of autism people are in the margins, but, you know, you look through history. There's a lot of people like Mozart and Einstein that would be labeled autistic today, and they had a very big effect on society.
Mm. And what would you account the difference to then in terms of somebody who's able to become a Newton or an Einstein or a Mozart, as in to communicate that bizarre way of seeing the world or that novel way of thinking, and the countless others who just aren't able to?
Well, they had to be in a situation where they could, learn the math. I mean, Einstein would have been given math books. One of the things that he did as a job was patent examiner. And so Swiss patent office would give him all the electronics, all the physics patents. So he was getting exposed to all kinds of new ideas in these patents. Mm. So it was a perfect job for him. And the person has to be put in a situation where they can flourish. I mean, Mozart lives in a society where music was highly valued.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's just luck of the draw then?
Well, I wouldn't say it's totally luck of the draw. I mean, it's having, because I think a lot of this is innate ability. But you also have to be in an environment where they can express it.
Mm.
Because, there's other kids that are really good at math, and they're getting bored to death in school, and they're not getting more difficult, harder math to do, and they're turning into behavior problems because nobody's working on developing their math ability. I think that's terrible. And they turn into a big, fat behavior problem, and they're totally bored.
Mm. Well, I mean, isn't that the approach of ABA, that it's essentially just tackling the behaviors and then actually conditioning?
Well, for example, a smart third grader that ought to be taking advanced math, he's beyond ABA.
Mm-hmm.
ABA is a little kid's program, mainly to get language going, and on some of the more, but you have a little math genius, you don't do ABA on him. You give him the high school math book if he can do it.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. His mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling.